This is Haunted America Radio with your host, Al Shepard Sr. and Al Shepard Jr. on 1370 AM WBTN. To discuss tonight's topics, please give us a call at 802-442-1010. That's 802-442-1010. And now, Haunted America Radio with Al and Al.
And good evening, everyone, to this week's edition of Haunted America Radio. My name's Al Shepard Sr., and I'm joined, as always, by my son and co-host, Al Jr. How you doing, Al?
Good, good. You?
Good. Been a busy, busy week here, that's for sure, between this show and Country Dreams, that's for sure. They both keep me hopping. Anyways, this week, we've got a special guest. We have author Brian, I hope I'm going to say this right, Brian Kinnard, author of Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. And let me give you a little bit of information on him.
Yeah, I was just reading through some of the chapter summaries there. It's pretty amazing.
Yep. After 11 years of working in the corporate world, Brian decided to leave his career behind and become a writer, and he opened Grave Distractions Publications. He caught the writing bug in 2006 when he began sharing his experiences as a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Mason and with the esoteric at the Grail Seekers blog. Since then, Brian's articles have been featured on such websites as CNN, Unexplained Mysteries, Coast to Coast AM, Red Ice Creations, and Daily Grail. His quest for hidden knowledge has taken Brian to various locations, including Scotland and France. The work done for Grail Seekers has been the topic of internet radio interviews, and most notably, the Pittsburgh area's Scottish Rite hosted Brian as a keynote speaker. Along the way, Brian has been honored to discuss his views with Thomas Steinbeck, Patrice Chaplin, Charlie's daughter-in-law, Bruce Burgess from Bloodline Documentary, and Reverend Lionel Fanthorpe. And assisting Brian in his efforts at their Nashville home are his lovely wife Laura, young son Robert, and the unholy black cat preacher. So I'd like to welcome Brian to Haunted America Radio. You with us, Brian?
I am. Thanks for having me on this evening.
Now, did I pronounce your last name right, Kinnard?
You sure did. You did better than most, Dave.
And I got a special interest in you being in Nashville. See, as my other show I do is Country Dreams. It's all independent country artists. So
I noticed that. So yeah, you'd fit in well down here.
Definitely. All right, I got to start off seeing that I'm very interested in the Masons and Masonic history and things like that, and actually kicking around the idea of whether I have the qualifications to become one. What exactly is a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Mason?
Yeah, I was wondering.
Well, Masonry is broken up into a couple of different types of organizations. At its base level, you have the first three degrees. You have Entered Apprentice, Fellowcraft, and Master Mason. And those are made up of what we call the Blue Lodge. And those are the lodges that, you know, you see around town. And then you have kind of advanced degrees. It's kind of like, postgraduate work, I guess, if you call it that, in either the Scottish Rite, York Rite, or in the Shrine. And there's some other organizations out there, like the Grotto and Tall Cedars of Lebanon and some other groups. But what these other degrees do is they just advance your knowledge in the esoteric and in Masonic lore. So a degree is basically kind of like a morality play that is staged for you, and you learn a number of symbols, moral lessons, and Masonic lore during these degrees. So I decided after I became a Master Mason to join the Scottish Rite and have advanced to the 32nd degree of that, which means I've gone through a number of these different morality plays and kind of advanced my knowledge in the lore and such. But it's a wonderful organization. We do a lot of charitable work. You know, organizations like the Scottish Rite have their Eye Foundation and support hospitals. The Shriners do wonderful work with burn hospitals. There's a great center in Cincinnati.
And they got cool little cars.
Yeah, the Shriners will take children that have been injured and free of charge transport them to this facility and give them the medical attention that they need. So it's a wonderful organization.
Now you mentioned, you said there's the Scottish, there's the Shriner, and what's the other section?
The York Rite.
York, right, okay. Hmm.
Right, and they all, once again, tell, you know, slightly different bits of lore about, you know, once again, Masonic history and other esoterica that goes along with it. But it's a great organization. I've been a Mason for over 10 years now. And I've gotten just a lot out of it.
Yeah, I know a friend of mine is a Mason here and head of the local chapter. And he told me they do a lot of things behind the scenes that they don't take credit for, and you don't even realize it. They just kind of work and be quiet and do their thing.
Well, yeah, in the Scottish Rite, one of our things, and that is, if we help out someone or a family or an individual, we do it in such a way that individual never knows where that assistance came from.
We're
not seeking the notoriety for doing those kind of good works, but yeah, we work behind the scenes, so to speak, in a very non-conspiratorial way.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of good works out there.
Well, I appreciate the work that you do.
Certainly.
And I know you help a lot of people. All right. Let's see. What else? You've been on all kinds of radio shows and this and that and everything else. So this may be a step down for you here with us hokums here in Vermont.
nothing's ever a step down. I love getting on the radio and talking about either the book or anything that comes up. So I'm just glad to be on.
Well, we got just about 2 hours here, and I know you got plenty of stuff in that book to fill it up with. That's for sure. I just want to take 1 second here just to let people know a few of our upcoming guests that are coming up. Next week, July 25th, is we're going to get started a little later at 8 p.m. Eastern time because the Red Sox take precedence around here on WBTN, and their game's starting at 3:30. So hopefully they will be done by 8 o'clock. If not, we'll come on right after they're done. And next week we got psychic criminal profiler Robbie Thomas, one of the most well-respected psychics in the law enforcement community. And law enforcement
Yeah, not the guy from Matchbox 20. No. Get excited, ladies.
And law enforcement doesn't put their endorsement on many psychics.
Mm-mm.
And this one, he's helped them quite a bit. The week after that, August 1st, is the director of the movie 14 Degrees, paranormal investigator Michael Baker. And I've had him on the show previously when we were on the internet. And definitely a nice guy and got some great scientific ideas. Coming up after that, August 8th, paranormal investigator CeCe the Huntress Carroll. They call her the Queen of the Paranormal. She's not afraid to go out there and do some paranormal investigating all by herself.
Hmm.
And a few more I just booked. September 26th, Bruce and Andrea Leiniger, authors of Soul Survivor, the story of their son James, what most people are calling the most well-documented case of reincarnation ever.
That's
James,
reincarnated
from World War II pilot.
Wow.
I have had them on the show before, spoke with them for 2 hours. I've read the book, and it's definitely will open your eyes up to a few things. October 3rd, a gentleman by the name of Gary Kanji, and I'm not even sure what his claim to fame was. He found me on Facebook. He says, "You got to have me on the show. It'll definitely be an interesting show." And we got talking for about an hour, and I can see that we're at opposite ends of the spectrum as far as paranormal goes. So that should be a great debate that evening as we bounce things off each other. And then October 10th, I just booked Ron Kolick, who is the host of Ghost Chronicles and Ghost Chronicles International with Richard Felix from Most Haunted. So we're going to get Ron back on here. So
sounds
now
good.
I got that out of the way here.
Back to Brian.
Now, I printed out on your site, you had a whole bunch of little snippets, I guess, about different chapters in your book and different tales.
Yeah, I can believe some of the names
that
were
on. And I printed it out, and it's like this thing went on forever. So right here, first thing on the top of the list here is Alexander the Great. Now, what's the story with Alexander the Great?
Well, Alexander, of course, conquered most of the known world back when he was around and got it just about as far as India and died a rather mysterious death. He was in his early 30s, but was seen by a lot of his conquered peoples as being a god. I mean, he was a brilliant and ruthless military commander and ruler. And his goals, of course, were world domination, and didn't quite get to that point. But after he died, most people think it was of malaria, possibly of poisoning. There was some consternation as to what to do with his body, and he was prepared for burial, and this great golden bier was created that took a year or two to actually make to transport Alexander's body back to Greece. Finally got completed, and the slow journey of taking his body back through his conquered lands began. Well, after he died, his empire was kind of split up between his generals, and one of his generals named Ptolemy had the bright idea that he would steal Alexander's body and take it to Alexandria in Egypt to solidify his rule to the Egyptian throne. And he did so, and it worked. It gave him the legitimacy of the ruler of Egypt. And we have a whole line of Ptolemaic rulers in Egypt after that, but he built this great tomb for Alexander that disappeared from history, I think in about the 300s or 400s, if I remember correctly. But Alexander's body has been lost to time. It's one of the holy grails of archaeology out there would be to find Alexander's tomb, and it's never been found. But the pardon me, the reason that Ptolemy did this, it was a totally politically motivated reason for a body snatching or grave robbery. People, once again, viewed the possession of Alexander's body as a magical thing. And Ptolemy had the juice after that and got the rule of Egypt. So that's just one of the reasons why we see grave robberies going on is for political motivations like that.
Now, I was just reading on, I think I saw a video on Facebook or something a week or so ago of a woman, I think she was like in her 80s, who had her husband and her sister exhumed from the cemetery and was actually keeping them at the house. The sister was upstairs, and the husband was out in the garage. And she just keeping them there, talking to them, and going about her life and everything until somebody found out about it. I mean, this is going on today still.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just as recent as last December, the ex-president of Cyprus had his body stolen a year to the day after he died by a rival political faction, and they stole his body simply for a protest purposes. And I believe 2 or 3 months later, they were actually caught. So these type things still happen today. I was quite shocked to learn that. I mean, I got interested in the topic by, I was contacted by a publicist friend of mine from Quest Publications, and she had sent me a copy of Patrice Chaplin's book, City of Secrets, and she wanted me to do a review and an interview with Patrice. And Patrice, when she was a young lady, had some esoteric experiences in Spain, and with a secret society that claimed to have the Holy Grail. Well, anyway, she chronicled that in her book, but I was doing some back-checking on the Chaplin family. You know, I knew a little bit about Charlie Chaplin, and Patrice, of course, is her daughter, or his daughter-in-law, and found out that in 1978, 3 months after Charlie died on Christmas Day in 1977, two out-of-luck auto mechanics in the little Swiss village where he spent his last few years decided that they were going to steal Charlie's body and ransom it back to the Chaplin family for, I believe it was £400,000. You know, and it's not a small sum of money now, but it was a lot more in 1978. And the Chaplin family thought all of this was incredibly ludicrous. Una Chaplin, Charlie's wife, had said that Charlie would have thought that the whole affair was ridiculous, and the Chaplin family refused to pay the ransom. So this drug out for 5, 6, 7 weeks, and the auto mechanics that stole Charlie's body started getting pretty antsy about the entire ordeal, and they decided to up the ante a little bit and actually started threatening the Chaplin family, or the children and the grandchildren. So the Swiss police stepped in, and the body nappers were supposed to call back at a predetermined time, and the Swiss police tapped over 200 phones throughout Switzerland of likely locations that these guys would call from, which was no small feat in 1978. I mean, when you're just getting fiber optics and computer-controlled telephone lines coming into existence. But they actually traced the phone call to a public call box and nabbed the two guys, who took the police to a field about a mile and a half away from where Charlie was originally buried, and dug him up in his de facto grave at that point, and got a couple years in prison for their crimes. And Charlie was returned to the small cemetery where he was buried, and literally over his coffin, they put a ton of concrete to make sure that this never happened again. And to this day, Charlie Chaplin still lays to rest in that small cemetery.
Jeez, that's crazy. I don't know how anybody think they get ransom for a dead body. I mean, if you hold on to it long enough, there isn't going to be anything left to ransom.
Exactly. But, you know, the two guys got auto mechanics got the idea from an article they'd read about the Italian mafia doing this quite frequently to rich and powerful families in Italy.
All right. Well, got to interrupt you for a second here. We got to take a little commercial break, pay a couple bills, and we will be right back on Haunted America Radio with Brian Kennard, author of Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. And we are back on Haunted America Radio, 1370 AM WBTN. Nothing like a little Nickelback to get the the blood flowing, the juices flowing, the blueses flowing. We are speaking with Brian Kennard here on the phone, author of Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. Going down through the list here, the next one I see here is John Barrymore. What's the scoop on him?
So, well, John Barrymore, of course, was the grandfather of actress Drew Barrymore, and was probably one of the most famous actors of the 20s, 30s, and early 40s. I mean, kind of if you rolled George Clooney and Brad Pitt together, that would describe the popularity of John Barrymore at the time. He was a brilliant Shakespearean actor, you know, had over 100 performances of Hamlet on Broadway. And unfortunately, in his later years, he had an alcohol problem. And it's not known whether he was slipping into Alzheimer's or if it was, an alcohol-induced dementia. But unfortunately, in the early 40s, he passed away. And being one of the Hollywood elite, he had a number of friends that he ran around with, like Humphrey Bogart and Paul Henreid, and his buddy Errol Flynn. And after he died, the story goes that someone stole his body from the Los Angeles funeral home that he was buried at and placed it in Errol Flynn's drawing room with a martini glass in his hand, because Errol Flynn and John Barrymore were big drinking buddies. Well, Errol Flynn was not home at the time, and as the story goes, Errol Flynn comes back home, and depending upon which version of the story that you believe, because there's three or four different ones that have floated around in Hollywood legend about John Barrymore, either Errol Flynn tipped his hat and had a drink with John Barrymore's corpse, or according to Flynn himself in one of his autobiography, he pretty much screamed like a little schoolgirl, ran outside and hit his bushes because it freaked him out so much.
Yeah, and I think I believe that one.
And probably wet himself along the way.
I probably would.
Probably so. But no one really knows what the truth of the matter is. There have been people that have come out that were close to Barrymore and Flynn and their entire group that said, that's a load. That never happened. There's one group of stories that Paul Henreid and Peter Lorre actually stole the body, possibly with Humphrey Bogart's help, and put it in Errol Flynn's drawing room. There was another group that said Raoul Walsh, who was a director and actor back then, did it as a gag. So nobody really knows whether the story is true or not. I'd like to think that there's some grain of truth to it, because if I was, the swashbuckling kind of guy that Errol Flynn was, I think I'd come up with a better story than I screamed and ran out and hid in the bushes, telling whoever it was to take Barrymore back to the funeral home. So that story's kind of one of those that's been ingrained in Hollywood and legend and lore for the last 50 or 60 years.
That's crazy. And I can picture a bunch of drunk friends doing that too, So especially sure. Especially ones in Hollywood that don't even care.
Well, they thought it would, be a fitting tribute, and they're kind of wake Barrymore too.
Yep.
I mean, from the camps that said that they were the ones that did it. And in the book, I actually hypothesized, I took a look at all the different stories that had told, and given the loose timeline of what happened, it could be that all the stories are true about it and just simply happened from different people's perspectives. So, who knows? Jeez, that's a great tale.
Yeah, it is. All right, next one on the list here, we've got the Bob and Tom Radio Show.
I want to.
Well, that's another one that kind of piqued my interest in all this. And, once again, we keep talking about motives for people actually, doing what we consider horrible things to corpses by stealing them. The John Barrymore thing was kind of a crass joke, but it wasn't necessarily a horrible thing to do. The Bob and Tom episode that I'm thinking of was along about 2004, 2005, driving into work. I was listening to the nationally syndicated comedy. If some of your listeners aren't familiar, I don't know if they play it locally up there or not. But they've been on the radio for a number of years and have kind of a comedy variety show in the mornings. And one of their shticks is, ever so often, they'll do a true confessions bit in their show where people either call in with, you know, odd true confessions or email. One of the emails that claimed that they received was from a gentleman who admitted that his best friend in childhood had recently died of some terminal disease. And when they were kids, his friend made him promise that if he died before the person that emailed in, he would take his corpse and actually give him a Viking funeral, which entails putting his body in a boat, casting it out into a body of water and setting it on fire and letting it burn in the middle of the lake or river or wherever you happen to be at. So, you know, of course, his friend didn't think much about this promise until his buddy became terminally ill. And one of the last declarations he had to his friend was, "Do you remember what you promised me when we were kids?" So the confessor was kind of struck with, so what do I do about this? Do I keep my promise to my friend that I made when we were kids, or do I do nothing about it? You know, chances are, depending upon what your belief structure is, he won't know the difference. But staying true to his word, he stole the body, and I believe it was in Minnesota. He took the corpse, set it on a boat, and lit it. Now, I couldn't find, I looked in a number of places to try to verify if this story was actually true or not, and I never could. But then again, a lot of these type things go unreported. You know, a funeral home wouldn't necessarily be quick to pick up the phone and call the local police and say, guess what?
Yeah, we lost the body.
Yeah, our security's not real good here.
Right. Yeah, that doesn't instill a lot of confidence in the community and your potential customers when, yeah, bodies end up missing. So, you know, a lot of these stories, they end up being swept under the carpet because of things like that. And simply because nobody really wants to think about what happens after we die a whole lot. We don't want to think that we're vulnerable at our most vulnerable after we pass away. But that's the sad fact of it.
My feeling's always been that once I'm dead, my body's no different than any other roadkill you see side the road at that point.
I agree.
Because my mother always said, oh, well, when you bury me, make sure I'm in a vault and blah, 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 and I don't want the worms to get me. And I looked her right in the face, and I said, do you plan on using that body again later? Well, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's where a lot of these beliefs actually come from, is a lot of the religious beliefs that people have, especially about resurrection. There are some people that believe that their bodies have to be intact along the same lines of the ancient Egyptians' belief to be whole after the second coming. So that's why you've had hesitation over the years to donate your body to science and people that have those beliefs. You know, I believe the same way that you do. I believe my body's just a husk, and I could care less what happens to me. Other people are not quite like that, and to each his own.
Yeah.
But that's where a lot of this stems from, and a lot of the reasons why we look away from stories like this, because there's something in our core that this really creeps people out, thinking that, once again, they might be ransomed off, or their kneecaps might be sold to some medical facility to be used in and somebody else for a transplant. That happened to a BBC actor and Masterpiece Theater presenter, Alistair Cook. He was in a funeral home, and one of the people that worked there actually sold some of his bones to a medical facility to be used in transplant purposes. So those type things still go on today, too.
Well, I'll put a call out right now to my wife. If she's able to sell my body to anyone after I'm gone, go right ahead, because obviously it's worth more that way than it is today. So if you can make a profit off me, you go for it. You know?
Sell me on eBay. Yeah.
Exactly. Put me up on eBay.
$50
you know?
For you in Mexico.
Exactly.
I wonder what we could get for that if you parted somebody out, you know, just put the individual parts
couple
on
grand, maybe.
Put the individual parts on eBay, you'd get more.
Well, you know, there was a story a couple months back about some body part of Mussolini showing up on eBay for a little while before it was taken down. They actually don't allow, and this is in their terms of service, they don't allow remains to be sold. So, you know, if you have, you know, the thigh bone of St. Bartholomew, you can't sell it on eBay.
That's not
I wonder if you could start it. There's an idea for a new website.
Guess I better
hey, there
that
you go.
Closet of body parts. Ain't going to do me no good.
Oh, man. All right.
There's some interesting ones on here. We should have them skip around.
Well, I was kind of
about
I was
Ed Gein.
All right, let's jump to Ed Gein. Tell us about Ed Gein. I know I saw a documentary on him or something on the History or
nuts.
Biography Channel or something, and it was very interesting.
Ed Gein is one of those people that has wormed his way into pop culture, unbeknowingly to most folks. He was a very, very odd fellow.
You think?
Yeah. Well, that's the kindest thing I can say about him, at least on the open airwaves. But he was the basis for Psycho, and also in Thomas Harris's novels Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs. The villains in both those novels are partially based on Ed Gein's life. But he's a very, very, very controlling mother who micromanaged every bit of his life. Him and his brothers, they were secluded from the rest of the world at his mother's wishes when he was a child. And she controlled literally every aspect of their lives. One of Ed's brothers died in an accident on the farm. Some people say that Ed did it. Some people say it was a pure accident. No one really knows for sure. And that just left Ed with his mother after his father passed away. And once Ed's mother died, Ed was devastated because he literally was his entire universe. He really didn't go to school, so he was an uneducated man. Did odd jobs around the town where he lived, and kept to himself. But most people think if they know anything about Gein, think that he was this great serial killer. I mean, he wasn't really a serial killer by strict definition, because he confirmed it only killed two people. One was the owner of a local bar, and the one that actually got him caught or found out was the owner of a hardware store there in the town he lived. But Ed, with the assistance of another gentleman that had a mental handicap, would go out and dig people up in the local graveyard. And Ed said that he performed experiments on them and duped his buddy into helping him out. Well, Ed did this for a number of years. It was speculated that he dug his mother up and had some unsavory things to do with his mother, too, post-mortem. And anyway, Ed went on with this activity for a number of years, killed a bar matron there in the town he lived in, and a little while later, actually, while everyone was out, I believe it was the opening of deer season, went into town and killed a woman in a local hardware store. Her son was the deputy sheriff there in town, and somebody had seen Gene go into the hardware store earlier that day, and no one had thought twice about Ed. I mean, like I said, he was kind of a little handyman around town, but really a sinister figure. They figured he was, you know, kind of slow and weird, but that's about it. So the deputy sheriff goes out to the Gene place just to see if Ed had seen anything or anybody else in the hardware store. And they go out to the shed. They can't find Ed. And when they go into the shed, they found, and the main house itself, found things like lampshades that were made out of human skin, bowls made out of skulls, wow. Necklaces made out of people's ears. These are the things that Ed Gene did with his spare time. Well, they go out to the shed eventually and find the deputy sheriff finds his mother hanging up. Gene was in the middle of actually making a woman's suit out of human flesh at that point. So Ed was quickly captured and put in jail for the rest of his life.
So Ed was an artist, basically.
He was something.
Wow.
But you know, we get the Texas Chainsaw Massacre out of that. We get Psycho out of that. We get a lot of influences in popular horror since then based on either the facts or misconceptions about what Ed Gein did. And certainly it was, you know, a god-awful, horrible human that would do these kind of things. And it creeped me out quite a bit writing that chapter. But pretty disturbing stuff from what I saw of some of the photos of the Gein home and the descriptions that ended up in court documents and police reports and that type thing.
All right, we got to take another commercial break here. Now, that was back in what, 40s and 50s or something with Gein?
Gein was back in the 50s.
50s, yeah.
I believe it was the early 50s.
All right, we'll be back after a few commercial messages with Brian Kennard, author of Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. You're listening to Haunted America Radio on 1370 AM, WBTN.
And now back to Haunted America Radio on WBTN 1370 AM.
And we are back with Brian Kennard, author of Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. And some of these are weird, some are creepy, some are funny. Which one? Do you have a favorite that we haven't covered yet?
Probably one of my favorites in the book is about William Wirt. And William Wirt was a presidential candidate in, I believe, the 1832 election and ran on the anti-Masonic ticket against Andrew Jackson and lost. He was also the first biographer of Patrick Henry and is the first instance of where we get the give me liberty or give me death speech in front of the House of Burgess was from William Wirt's biography of Patrick Henry. William Wirt died in the 1840s, was laid to rest in Congressional Cemetery in Washington, D.C. Congressional Cemetery is kind of an interesting place. Washington found itself without anywhere to bury statesmen that passed away while in office in the late 1700s. So they contracted with a small cemetery there in Washington to to provide that service to senators and congressmen that died while in office. And William Wirt was buried there. And they do a great work there and have a number of quite famous people that are buried there. I believe Admiral Byrd is buried there, if I remember correctly. I know Civil War photographer Matthew Paris was buried there. A number of folks. But they keep up the work on a very shoestring budget. They really don't have any federal funding per se, other than the cemetery fees for the burials, but do a really good job of keeping the cemetery and the history of the cemetery up. But along about 2003, around Christmas, the manager of Congressional Cemetery, a guy named Bill Feck, gets an odd phone call from a woman. And she says, "Do you know about William Wirt?" And he says, "Well, yeah, sure, he's buried here." He says, "Would you be interested in knowing that William Wirt's skull is not in his grave?" Well, this just blew Feck away, because he'd been the cemetery manager there for a few years and had no idea that his grave had been broken into, if this woman was pulling his leg. He tried to get some more information out of her and talked to her for a little while, and that was about it. And for the next few weeks, she would call up asking if he had found anything out or if he was interested in more information about William Wirt's skull. Well, Feck had gone out to check out the grave site, and there had been some storm damage to a number of the graves in the same row that Wirt's grave was in. It was actually a tomb, and a number of his family members had been buried there as well. And he couldn't really tell without opening up the actual crypt and going inside. And eventually the call stopped. Well, a little time passes, and a Washington, D.C. city councilman calls Feck up and says, "Hey, do you know anything about William Wirt and his skull?" Well, of course, at this point, Feck's thinking this is the cemetery manager's version of "Is your refrigerator running?" And says, "Well, you know, I've had somebody calling me about that. What's your interest in it?" And he says, "Oh, well, in a rosewood box sitting on my desk, I have William Wirt's skull." Well, this just confounded Feck, and evidently one of the people in the district there had given the councilman a box containing his skull with gold lettering on the side that said William Wirt. Well, Congressional Cemetery, like I said, runs on a shoestring budget, and they knew that in order for them to actually ascertain whether this was Wirt's skull or not, they would need some pretty extensive excavations done, you know, possibly a forensic anthropologist to come in. And it kind of got lost in red tape and with finances at Congressional for about a year, where this skull sat on this Washington, D.C. councilman's desk. So finally, Feck and one of the board members, a guy by the name of Patrick Crowley, who I interviewed for the book, opened up Wirt's tomb and looked inside, and there were something like six or seven different family members that were buried with Wirt. But they could tell immediately just by looking in that all of the graves were disturbed. There were bones all over the floor, and they knew that they would need somebody besides themselves to literally sort out the mess. So they called the Smithsonian and got a forensic anthropologist to come in, a doctor by the name of Dr. Owsley, who actually worked with the Kensington Man and I believe on the Waco case identifying remains. Well, literally one day they pieced all the bones back together and ascertained that William Wirt's skull was in fact missing. Well, by this point, the local media had gotten a hold of the story and had run a piece about D.C. Councilman has William Work's skull sitting on his desk. And Councilman kind of had enough of playing host to the skull, and Patrick Crowley went over to his office and picked up the skull and walked it over to the Smithsonian for further identification. And Crowley said it was kind of surreal walking around the D.C. streets with a skull and a box under his arm. But it was ascertained that that was William Wirt's skull. And in doing that, Owsley, the forensic anthropologist, was missing a couple of the top vertebrae from Wirt's remains and had gone back to the Wirt's tomb to try to find them. Because, you know, our bones fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. And if the two top vertebrae had matched up correctly, it would have been an automatic identification without doing anything like DNA testing or anything actually any more evasive to the remains than they did. Well, doing so, Owsley found behind the little ladder that led down into the crypt the bones of an infant that had been placed there. Owsley reckoned within the last 20 years. And there was record of anyone being buried in Work's tomb since, I believe, like the 1860s or 1870s. So no one knows who that child was. They called the D.C. police, and the D.C. police investigated it and could not find out who that the remains of the infant was. And still to this day, from what I could find out, that case was never closed. But in the entire investigation into that, the D.C. city councilman admitted who had given him Work's skull to begin with. It was an antiquities appraiser that worked there in Washington, D.C., that had appraised the collection of a gentleman by the name of Robert White. You might remember this has been, you know, within the last few years, White died. He had the largest private collection of John F. Kennedy memorabilia in the world. He had a Rolex, a watch of Kennedy's, a number of other large Kennedy items in his private collection. And when he died, this appraiser had come in to value the collection and found William Wirt's skull in his collection. And had told the D.C. councilman about this, and he said, well, I'll tell you what, give the skull to me, I'll call congressional, we'll get it back to him. Well, it took over a year, but it finally happened. Nobody really knows exactly who the original caller was, though. It was female, and there's some speculation that it was actually Robert White's wife after she was made aware that Work's skull was in her husband's collection. But nobody really knows for sure. And there's kind of a weird caveat to all this. Crowley said that there were two gentlemen from Oklahoma that had been in contact with him when all this made the media and had come out to the cemetery after it was all over with, questioning him pretty hard about what they'd found out and some of the particulars of the case. And Crowley had no idea who they were or what their motivations were. And when Crowley couldn't give them the information that they wanted, they kind of evaporated into thin air, never to be heard from again. So a lot of mysterious circumstances surrounding William Wirt, a lot of unanswered questions, and a lot of interesting hypotheses to that.
Kind of like the Men in Black, huh?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, there's no telling. I mean, I actually found out about the Wirt story while watching a History Channel special on the Masons. That it was brought up about him being on an anti-Masonic ticket, and his body was stolen. And they said that it was, you know, alluded to the fact that it was to some sinister ends, of course, by us evil Freemasons, which is more than likely not the case. Or at least I don't know any Masonic grave robbers out there.
All right, well, we got to head to the top of the hour with the news here. It would be interesting to find out how Mr. White came up with that in the first place, though.
It would be.
That'd be kind of interesting. All right, you're listening to Haunted America Radio here on 1370 AM WBTN. We're talking with Brian Kennard, author of Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. And we'll be back with more of those fascinating true tales right after the AP News. Do not go away.
This is Haunted America Radio with your host, Al Shepard Sr. and Al Shepard Jr. on 1370 AM WBTN. To discuss tonight's topics, please give us a call at 802-442-1010. That's 802-442-1010. And now, Haunted America Radio with Al and Al.
Well, you got one Al here at the moment. I think the other one's having a smoke break. So, but, you know, kids, what can you do? We are on board here tonight with author Brian Kennard. We're discussing his book, Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead, and... It's very interesting stories on such a morbid subject, though. But during the break, we were talking about different people in history. I mentioned I do Civil War reenacting, and history's something I'm quite interested in. And we mentioned John Harrison. So why don't you tell us about John Harrison?
John Harrison was the father of Benjamin Harrison and the son of William Henry Harrison. And John was more or less a farmer. He was a lawyer in Ohio. He was a senator for, I believe, a term or two. But he passed away in the 1870s. And Benjamin Harrison, of course, was beginning his political career after being a colonel in the Union Army during the Civil War. As a matter of fact, he fought here in the Battle of Nashville, and his line originally was not too far from where my house rests right now. But anyway, he had come home from a political event for his father's funeral, the family farm was right outside Cincinnati. And the day of John Harrison's funeral, they noticed that a cousin of theirs who had passed away, a young man, his early to mid-20s, his grave was empty, and someone had stolen his body probably the night before John Harrison's funeral. So Benjamin Harrison and his brother decided that fate was not going to befall their father. So they made arrangements that day after John Harrison died to have a rotating watch set up for his crypt. They reinforced his crypt with brick and mortar, I believe, and extra marble slabs, and thought that their father was safe. And the next day, while visiting the graveyard, it was found out that John Harrison's body had been stolen in the middle of the night, even with all the precautions that they had taken. Benjamin Harrison had to leave after the funeral to go back to whatever political event that he had been part of. And it was left up to Benjamin Harrison's younger brother and another cousin of theirs to find the body of John Harrison. And back then, the most common reason for grave robbery was the use of bodies as cadavers in medical schools. Because back then, kind of alluded earlier in the interview to a lot of the religious reasons why people did not donate their body to science, and that was unheard of back then. In order to have a legal cadaver for a medical school, the cadaver had to be a criminal who was either executed or died in the commission of a crime. So you had a supply and demand issues with cadavers. There were many more medical schools out there that needed cadavers for medical studies than the prisons could actually provide. So medical students had to literally go out if they wanted their own cadaver and dig one up. Wow. So prevalent this was, there was actually a riot near Yale campus because of this very same thing. There in New Haven, a young lady had died. She was 19 or 20 and was very popular around town and died of some malady. But it was found the day after she was buried that her body had been dug up. And the people in New Haven had enough of that. And literally for about a week, they rioted on the Yale campus to the point the governor had to call out the local militia to make sure the townspeople didn't burn the campus to the ground. But anyway, so that was along the same lines of thinking that John Jr. Harrison and the cousin had when trying to go out and look for John Sr.'s body. So they went to Cincinnati and started searching through the different medical schools there and came up with nothing until they got to this one facility. And they'd searched the operating theaters and found nothing. And the janitor that had let them in said, you know, you're not really going to find anything. School's not in session. You know, there's no reason that we should be receiving cadavers anyway because there aren't any classes going on right now. Well, at the top floor, John Jr. spied basically a dumbwaiter that was used to lift the cadavers between floors and opened it up and saw that the rope pulley system was actually taut, like there was a weight at the end of it. Pulled up the pulley, and there staring him in his face was his father. His beard had been shaved off. His hair, he had a full head of dark hair, had been dyed gray. As part of the process.
They didn't want anybody to recognize him?
Well, that's one theory as to why it happened, or why they did that to him. That was a common practice back then, too, to try to change the features of someone so they couldn't be identified. There's also another possibility, too. In the investigation of all this, the Cincinnati police charged the janitor with complicity to this for receiving the body. And another person was put under arrest, too, a man by the name of Dr. Charles Morton, who was a traveling doctor that had been known to supply cadavers to medical schools. But Dr. Morton had another secret. That was actually a fake name, and he was actually a man by the name of Henry McCarran, who had fought in the same division that Benjamin Harrison had in the Battle of Nashville, and was, oddly enough, a spy for the British government. McCarran was tasked with infiltrating the Fenian movement here in the United States after the Civil War to keep tabs on Irishmen who might, Irish Civil War veterans that might want to go back to Ireland with their newfound skills and wrestle Ireland away from English control. And the entire movement was pretty big here in the States. As a matter of fact, the Fenians attacked Canada twice to make their point and were repelled both times. But McCarran infiltrated them and kept sending back their movements and what their plans were back to the British government. And after the Civil War, he had become a doctor. As a matter of fact, during the Civil War, he was a cavalry scout that operated in the Middle Tennessee area, married a girl here from Nashville, too, and lived here for a time. But we don't know whether he knew Benjamin Harrison or not. I've never been able to find conclusive evidence of that. But it seems interesting to me that a man wrapped up in the Fenian Brotherhood, who a number of years later, the Fenian Brotherhood was instrumental in getting Benjamin Harrison elected to the presidency, was involved in stealing Harrison's father's body. Once again, a lot of interesting dots here that historically we can't connect, but I make the supposition in the book that this might have actually been an action by the Fenian Brotherhood to put pressure on the Harrison family for some political end. And certainly, like I said, Benjamin Harrison was sympathetic to the Fenian cause, even promoted a number of key Fenian Brotherhood members to his cabinet against the wishes of a number of folks, one of which that had been involved in a bombing plot in London and was well known to have done that. So there's a lot of possible intrigue in John Harrison's body snatching. And the shaving of the beard and the dyeing of the hair could have been another message, too. Those are both symbolic acts of emasculation. You know, a man's beard shows his virility. A full head of dark hair, even in old age, once again, is another sign of a strong person. Dyeing his hair and shaving his beard might have been another subtle message to that. Who knows? It's an interesting tale nonetheless.
Yeah, it just seems to me like, okay, so I have this dead body here, but as long as you can't identify it, I can keep it, right? You know,
pretty much, yeah. You know, no fingerprints, no DNA back then.
Yeah, as long as you know, nobody claims it, then I can use it, right? You know. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, as long as we're on Civil War here, I want to ask you about Abraham Lincoln, but I know that one's going to take a little bit because I got some extra stuff I want to plug into that particular subject. So
okay.
let me take a quick break here and get these commercials out of the way, and we'll come right back with Brian Kennard, author of Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead, here on Haunted America Radio, 1370 AM, WBTN. And we are back on Haunted America Radio. Just Nickelback just keeps you in the mood here.
In the mood.
And we're on the phone with Brian Kennard, author of Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. And we were talking about Benjamin Harrison and the Civil War. So I think it's a perfect time now to jump over to the incredible story of Abraham Lincoln and how not to commit a crime.
That's certainly the truth. Of course, you know, Lincoln had a rather hurried tomb and memorial erected to him in Springfield, Illinois. And around about 1876, a thug in Chicago that was involved in all sorts of criminal activity, especially counterfeiting, by the name of Big Jim Keneally, who ran a shady bar called The Hub, had his chief engraver, Ben Boyd, pinched by the Secret Service and thrown in the clink in the Illinois State Pen. And this put quite a bind on Keneally's income, because Ben Boyd was probably the best counterfeit engraver in the United States at the time, at least according to the reports that I've read. So Keneally, for whatever reason, however he came up with this idea, possibly because the only adornment of the hub, his bar, was oddly enough a bust of Abraham Lincoln that sat up on a shelf, came up with the grand idea that I'll get a crew together and steal Abraham Lincoln's body, trade it for full cash, and the release of Ben Boyd, and all will be right with my world. So Keneally got a team together and decided to have a pretty decent plan. He set them up with a bar in Springfield so they could run the bar, get to be known in the town, get intelligence about the memorial and figure out exactly how to break in and what the best time would be. And for a number of months, the crew of Keneally's did just that, pretty flawlessly, up until the point about a week before they were actually going to go and steal the body. They decided that they were going to have one last hurrah and got drunk one night and went to a house of ill repute and started shooting their mouths off that, you know, come this time next week, we're going to have plenty of money. We'll see you girls all the time. Well, Keneally got word of this and decided that it was to put the kibosh on that crew. Cooled his plans for a little while and then decided that he had all this time and effort invested in the venture and didn't want to give up on the idea. So he recruited another group of four or five lads to go back in and do the same thing. Well, evidently Keneally was one of the most unlucky criminals in the history of the United States, because one of the people he recruited was a guy by the name of Louis Swigels, who was also an informant to the Secret Service. So as soon as Swigels heard what the heist was, he reported back to his Secret Service contact, who was the head of the Chicago division, a guy by the name of Patrick Terrell. And Terrell was pretty taken back by the entire plot. And back then, the Secret Service, which Lincoln had actually put into motion, was their entire purpose was to keep the currency supply safe, which meant going after counterfeiters, making sure Federal Reserves and such were safe. They didn't really have that many police powers other than that. So when Terrell heard about this, he telegrams back to the Washington station and says, all right, we've got a plan to steal Abraham Lincoln's body. What do we do? Well, the Washington Bureau was not really too interested in getting involved with it. For one, body snatching in Illinois at the time was not a crime. And we find this again and again in a lot of the stories that I talk about in the book, that the laws didn't necessarily marry up with what these people were doing in cemeteries. A lot of grave robbers, even up to the 1970s, were charged with things like destruction of property or theft, because desecration of the dead was not a law that was on the books, that was a criminal activity. So that was the case here in Illinois at the time. And it actually took Terrell getting in touch with Robert Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's living son.
Yeah, those people that are listening here locally will know Robert Lincoln from his house Hildeen, which is about 25 miles north of here in Manchester, Vermont.
Oh, that's right.
Yep, Robert Todd Lincoln's estate. We've actually been there a couple times ourselves, did a Civil War reenactment up there once, and I was actually there filming a movie up there, actually, a little documentary that I was lucky to be a part of. It's funny. I was sitting there watching the documentary one night, and I says, I remember that part. I was sitting there watching when they filmed that. And my daughter says, well, you should have. That's you. I said, it is?
Oh, that's funny.
But anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted local listeners know that Robert Todd Lincoln was who you were just about to discuss.
Yes. Well, Robert used his political influence to get the Secret Service and Terrell involved in the case. So 0 hour happens, which happened to be on election night in 1876. It was the time for Big Jim Keneally's men to go. And the thought was that, of course, back then, everyone got their news from the telegraph stations. So it was basically on election night, just like we do today, instead of huddled around the TV looking for returns. Everyone was at the telegraph stations waiting for the returns to come. So nobody would be watching anything going on in town, especially Abraham Lincoln's memorial. So Patrick Torelli got word from this from Swigels and recruited a number of his Secret Service agents in Chicago and a number of detectives from the Pinkerton Agency. And they had gotten to the Lincoln Memorial there early that morning. And they decided that they would get in a back room adjacent to where Lincoln's sarcophagus was and simply wait. And they did, and they realized very quickly that the floor there in the memorial was marble, and the boots that they were wearing, if they walked around, would click on the floor quite loudly and echo, giving away their position. So Terrell ordered that all the men take their shoes off. And they did, and they waited, and they waited, and they waited. Until about 10 or 11 o'clock that night, they heard some activity where the sarcophagus was. And this is, once again, another group of brilliant criminals that we have pulling this heist off for Keneally. They got to the gate that was right there in front of the sarcophagus, which had a rather large padlock on it, and all four of them realized that none of them knew how to pick a lock. So they had to take a file and literally file through the lock. And that took 20 or 30 minutes for them to do. Finally get the lock off. They opened the lid on the sarcophagus and tried to get the coffin out. Well, unfortunately, unbeknownst to them, the marble sarcophagus that Lincoln was originally buried in was built just a tad bit too small for the coffin. They literally had to wedge the coffin into the sarcophagus, and they couldn't get it out by any normal means. So they had to cut the front of the sarcophagus off. And as they did so, it finally the marble top of it came off, or front piece of it, and they were sliding the coffin out. At that point, our snitch, Lewis Swigels, goes back around to the memorial and gives the hootie-hoo signal to the waiting Secret Service men and Pinkerton detectives. And it's go time. So the Pinkerton detectives go around one side of the memorial. The Secret Service agents go around the other side. And as they're trying to converge upon our would-be grave robbers, one of the Secret Service agents' pistols goes off. Scares off the grave robbers. They get in the wagon that they had brought to tote Lincoln's remains off in and disappear into the night. Well, as the Secret Service agents and the Pinkerton agents come around the memorial, each group thinks that the other is our would-be grave robbers. And the Pinkerton detectives and Secret Service agents have a little gun battle between themselves before they figure out that they're both friendly. Grave robbers get away. But not to fear, because Swigels hadn't let them, the Secret Service, know exactly where they would reconnoiter, and that was at the hub at Big Jim Keneally's bar. So the next morning, Terrell comes in and snatches up the other grave robbers that were involved in the plot and arrests them. And once again, the only thing that they can be charged with is destruction of property. And after that, laws were passed in Illinois to make grave robbing illegal. But the story doesn't quite end there. You know, we have John Powers, who was the person that was tasked with keeping the grounds there at the Lincoln Memorial. He was faced the next morning with an Oddfellows convention in town, and a number of people coming to the Lincoln Memorial just to visit it, sightseeing. Well, he decided, not knowing what the fate of the grave robbers were or whether they'd be back, to take Lincoln's coffin to the basement of the memorial. And he does so, and it's a rather large lead coffin. It takes two or three of them to carry it down there, and he quickly repairs the sarcophagus and opens up for business as normal. Well, for a number of years, Abe Lincoln's remains stayed in the basement of the Lincoln Memorial there in Springfield. And Robert Powers had tried to rebury the remains in the basement, but the water table was pretty high there. And every time they try to dig in certain spots, they'd hit water. So he camouflaged the coffin with leaves and trash and old boards down there. So one of our greatest presidents had his remains hidden by old boards and for a number of years until Mary Todd Lincoln passed away. And her wish was to be buried next to Abe, of course. Well, Powers was kind of in a pickle at this point. He still had Abe's casket in the basement and decided that Mary Todd Lincoln should be buried there too. So they found a spot suitable for both of them to be buried and finally buried them both in the basement of the memorial. Well, this would have all been fine and dandy and the world would have been none the wiser, except the Lincoln Memorial was put up in such haste because of Lincoln's untimely death that the architecture was shoddy. And it was decided that the entire monument had to be torn down and rebuilt. And Powers had to finally come clean as to what he did. And he told Robert Lincoln what he had done and why he had done it. And reportedly, Robert Lincoln was pretty moved by what Powers had done for his family and what he had done to try to keep his father safe or his father's remains safe. Powers even recruited a number of his friends into a little secret society that knew of where Lincoln's remains were and called them Lincoln's Honor Guard. And, you know, they were tasked with keeping his remains safe. Well, once they rebuilt or were in the process of rebuilding the memorial, Powers came kind of clean to the public and they moved the remains of Mary Todd Lincoln and Abe Lincoln and their children that had passed away earlier to a grave in front of the memorial. And they were buried quite deeply over mounds of dirt and had guards over them at pretty much all times. And finally, in I believe it was 1910, they finally finished the work on... No, I'm sorry, it was 1901. They finished the work on the Lincoln Memorial and re-exhume the bodies and are getting ready to place them back into the new sarcophaguses, or sarcophagi, I guess would be the correct term. And the workmen had heard so many stories working on the site about the grave robbery that they wanted to make sure that this was actually Abe Lincoln. So one of the workmen called for his 12-year-old son to come and view them cracking open the coffin because he knew this was going to be a historic event. And these men very solemnly took the lid off the coffin, and sitting there in a incredible state of preservation was Abraham Lincoln. The only thing that they could tell that was different about him was his face was bronzed, just like he looks on a penny. And it's been hypothesized that that was because of the bullet that John Wilkes Booth fired into his skull was never taken out. And the lead leached out into Lincoln's skin, turning it that bronzish, coppery color. But they were able to confirm that that was actually Abraham Lincoln and laid him to rest once again in his final resting place. I believe it's about 20 feet down and under several feet of concrete to make sure that his remains are never disturbed again. But all told, his body was moved after his initial burial there, I believe about 10 times until he rests where he does today.
10 times in a period of about 36 years, something like that.
Yeah.
And I believe they cracked it open two or three times to look in there and make sure he was still there, right?
And each time
they were amazed at the embalming job that they did on him, that he was just almost picture perfect 30 years later.
And Lincoln was actually one of the reasons that embalming caught on here in the United States. It was a relatively new science in the Civil War, and when people found out that Lincoln had been embalmed, it kind of became a fad thing for people to be embalmed, because that didn't happen before then that often.
Yeah, well, you never know when you want to get dug up 30 years from now and somebody will want to bring you to a party and have a drink with Errol Flynn or something.
See, there you go.
Anyways, when I was speaking with you, it brought to my mind a book that I read, which was called The Escape and Suicide of John Wilkes Booth. It was written by Finis Bates, who was actually the grandfather of actress Kathy Bates, which many may know from various movies. And this book details how John Wilkes Booth was not killed right after the assassination of Lincoln, as we were all taught, but yet actually escaped and actually died, I believe it was like 1903 or something like that, in Enid, Oklahoma. And after that, his body was preserved or mummified and went on quite a journey. So I kind of stuck the bug in your ear there. I figured maybe, you know, if there's a part two to your book, you need a new story. So I figured I'd get you started.
I appreciate that.
What did you find out about this mummy of John Wilkes Booth? Anything?
Well, yeah, of course the backstory was there at Garrett's Farm. John Wilkes Booth somehow survived. And there were a number of Army officers there on the scene that were familiar with Booth that ID'd the body. But as you well know, there are a lot of stories and conspiracy theories that have floated around the entire Lincoln assassination.
Well, for as many people that were there and identified his body, it seems like there's just as many people that were there that said, no, that was not him. The hair color was wrong and everything. And then various stories of one bridge that was left open on the way out of Washington, D.C. right after the assassination, when all the other bridges were locked down. But this one, someone came along and gave the password and was let out of the city. And it's a very interesting book. It's kind of an older, you know, it's written 100 years ago. It's older English. So it's kind of hard to read, but it is available on the internet free as a PDF if you can find it. You search for Escape and Suicide of John Wilkes Booth. So, go ahead.
And there was another book written either in the late 60s or early 70s, I believe, called The Lincoln Conspiracy, that revisits some of these same topics, too. But the backstory on that is that I believe the gentleman's name was David E. George, that died in Enid, Oklahoma, said on his deathbed that he was actually John Wilkes Booth. And was it Bates that he was a Memphis lawyer, if I remember correctly, bought his remains that were mummified, and they were actually put on display for a number of months there in Oklahoma because of the controversy that surrounded his deathbed confession. And somebody, after Bates had gotten the mummy, it changed hands five or six different times and actually went on tour around the country. I believe Stephen Jay Gould's million-dollar show back then actually had it at one point, and it was carried around. And there was supposedly a curse behind it, too, because everyone that owned it ended up in financial ruin for a number of years. But in the 1930s in Chicago, it was actually x-rayed to see if injuries from Booth's leaping from the balcony there at Ford's Theater were consistent with the mummies. And I didn't really find any direct evidence of what that concluded, but they were taken and they are somewhere. And the mummy itself disappeared from history in the mid-70s, and no one knows where that's at now either, which wouldn't be nice to do DNA samples on, because you could probably confirm whether it was John Wilkes Booth now or not.
Well, I know there's some that have been fighting trying to get them to exhume what's supposedly John Wilkes Booth's body to do DNA testing to prove that it's not him in that grave. Just a little more backstory. Not only did David George on his deathbed say he was John Wilkes Booth, but before that, they said he had a really big knowledge of a large knowledge of Shakespeare, and he used to act almost, you know, exactly like John Wilkes Booth would. Mannerisms and everything were the same, and he'd just sit around in a bar and he'd quote Shakespeare and stuff. So, and which was really out of character for what his supposed persona was, the story that he told people. So there is quite a bunch of evidence there that points toward it very well could be true. So
sure.
would be kind of neat to get a hold of that mummy just to see.
It would be. I mean, you know, the stories around those type of things follow around people like Jesse James, too. There's been speculation that he's not buried where and died where he was historically supposed to have been buried, too. And there's been a movement to exhume his body and take DNA samples, too.
Yep, I remember hearing that, too, that legend's going around as well.
Speaking of bodies that they'd like to find, I've got a question. What's your take on Jesus Christ? Do you think that's like a big body snatching conspiracy?
Well, it could be. I mean, it depends on what your religious beliefs are there. I mean, you know, if you're a devout Christian and believe that, you know, Jesus was divine and the Son of God, then no. If you're not, then one of the world's major religions was started on the back of an elaborate grave robbery. You know, once again, it depends on what your take is.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Into the religion a whole lot about that. That's each individual, but it just depends on what your point of view is.
That's a few thousand years back where it's hard to find evidence one way or the other.
Exactly. Well, you know, which also brings up an interesting point that I talk about in the book. You know, we give a pass to archaeologists who exhume 2,000, 3,000, 4,000-year-old bodies mm-hmm. all the time in the name of science.
Yep.
But, you know, this was another thing that I remembered while writing the book. My grandmother was, God love her, she lived about 45 minutes west of Nashville and had about a fifth or sixth grade education. Her and my grandfather was good salt of the earth country folk. And she used to tell a story about some family member that had died during the Depression and had been buried with their wedding band. And there was a big consternation in the family that this person shouldn't be buried with this valuable ring. And my grandmother would always end up the story with, and you know what they did that night? They went out and dug that body up and they took that ring. That ain't going to happen to me.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so like where does the statute of limitations stop? You know, when does grave robbing become archaeology?
That's a good question.
You know, like how old do you have to be where it's okay for the guy from Chasing Mummies there on History Channel to come dig you up, you know?
Exactly. I mean, how would you feel in 1,000 years?
I don't think I'd feel anything.
Well, I know, but there's some folks out there, once again, that have strong beliefs about that, you know, watch the Bob Ryers of the world, Egyptologists, you're right. Going in the tombs and oh, that's interesting. Well, what if it was your body?
Yeah, really.
National Geographic in, you know, 2150.
Yeah, I want National Geographic to take my picture now, you know, like the naked women in Africa or something. Okay, we got to take our last commercial break here. We will be back in just a few minutes with Brian Kinnard, Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead.
That's a great image to go commercial
on. Haunted America Radio, 1370 AM. WBTN.
Mm-hmm. Got a long time to go, so hope we don't get hemorrhoids.
Are you really concerned about that?
All right, we are back on Haunted America Radio, 1370 AM WBTN. And thank you to those listening on, let's see, we got Knight Rider Radio, the turbocharged music mix station, listening in out there on the internet, as well as Club Calypto Radio, I believe, is tuned in as well. So we're getting all over the place tonight. We have with us author Brian Kennard. We've been talking about his book, Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. And we got about 10 minutes here to the end of the show, so we're going to cover a couple more here. What do you want to do next, Brian?
Well, we talked about Saint Nicholas. Let's talk about him a little bit. Of course, everyone knows jolly old Saint Nick, and are linking him to Santa Claus. But there's a different story about Saint Nicholas than most people know. He was a real honest to goodness person that lived in modern day Turkey back in the 300s. And he was brought up by his very rich parents, and who died while he was a teenager. And he was given the choice of continuing his family's merchant business or entering into the priesthood. So he decided to take his family's wealth and do good with it and join the priesthood, and would go out at night and pitch little gold balls into people's houses that he knew had need. And that's where we get the tradition, especially here in the South, of giving oranges at Christmas. Comes from him giving away gold. Anyway, St. Nicholas was a very influential person at the time. He was actually part of the Council of Nicaea, which determined which books were in the Bible, traveled to the Holy Lands a couple of times. And when he died, at his funeral service, there was a milky white substance that supposedly flowed from his tomb that had miraculous powers. And from time to time, this phenomena would happen. Well, of course, the town that he was in Turkey became a popular pilgrimage spot. And because of his traveling, too, he was a patron saint of a number of different groups, and one of which was sailors. Well, we flash forward to the Crusades, and there were two groups that did most of the shipping in the Mediterranean back then. It was the Venetians and shippers from the Italian town of Bari. And for years, they had tried to get their hands on St. Nicholas's relics to enhance their reputation as shippers. You know, we've got the relics of the patron saint of sailors. You know, come sail on our ships. Well, every attempt that they'd made to beg, borrow, or steal St. Nicholas' remains were, of course, rebuffed by the church there, because they had a pretty good economic base of pilgrims that would come to St. Nicholas's tomb. Well, during the Crusades, Muslim forces actually overran the city that St. Nicholas was buried in. And our sailors from Venice and Bari decided that this was the right time to liberate the bones of St. Nicholas from the infidels. So the story goes that the Bari sailors actually got there first and encountered three monks who were left behind to guard St. Nicholas's remains. And the Bari sailors said, "All right, we're here to take St. Nicholas's remains back to Italy with us to keep them safe." Said, "You're not doing it over our dead bodies." Well, unfortunately, that's exactly what happened. The Bari sailors killed the three monks and took the remains of St. Nicholas back to Bari, where there's a cathedral to St. Nicholas to this day. Well, the Venetians couldn't be outdone. So they said, well, the Barimen might have gotten there first, but they didn't get it right. They got the remains of Nicholas's father. We opened up another tomb and found a palm leaf that was buried with St. Nicholas from one of his trips to Jerusalem that looked like it had been picked yesterday. So this miracle must mean that we have the genuine St. Nicholas remains. So they took the remains back to Venice and built another cathedral to St. Nicholas that stands today. So no one's really sure where jolly old St. Nicholas rests, whether it be in Bari, Venice, or if it was in the third tomb there in Turkey.
That's crazy. So you got two different places. Take your pick. And
yeah,
if you visit them both, then you're bound to get it right at least.
Exactly.
Oh.
So that's the story of St. Nicholas. And, you know, once again, we see for religious reasons, too, in a number of the stories that people collect remnants and remains because of, you know, belief in those remains having some kind of power to them.
That's crazy. We got about 5 minutes left here, and just quick, in a minute or less here, what's this Ghost Brides of China?
Well, the Chinese have a very strong component of their religious beliefs that's modern in ancestor worship. So they actually believe that in order to keep your lineage, someone has to be married, whether on this side of death or on the other. So if a young man or young woman dies before they're married, they can actually be married in the grave. So a group of Chinese men decided that they were going to murder young women to create ghost brides for prospective buyers.
Jeez.
And actually murdered a couple of women before they were caught and dropped off the site of the Chinese prison system. I had seen an interview with one of them that was very unrepentant, and the Chinese don't have a very extensive appeals process, so I'm sure he's looking for his own ghost bride at this point.
I imagine, but that sounds like another website you could start.
There you go.
All right, we got about 3 minutes left here. Why don't you tell people where they can purchase your book, Skullduggery, okay. 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead, and any other books you have going on in the works?
Sure. Well, the website for the book is www.skullduggerythebook.com. We're available on Amazon. We're in Barnes & Noble's catalog, Books A Million's catalog, Tower catalog. There are links to all those on the website. There's also a $2 off coupon for purchase on one of the sites. We're available via ebooks on Kindle and in any number of other formats, and all those links are on the site too. My publishing company will actually be at the Southern Festival of Books in October. So if you happen to be in Nashville and at the Southern Festival of Books, Grave Distractions Publications will have a booth set up there. And the website for that is www.gravedistractions.com. We've been open since the beginning of the year and have worked on projects for 5 or 6 different authors with about 10 different titles. So we believe that there are authors out there that were just like me that need a little help getting published, and that's what we're about. So, and I'm working on my second book right now, which is going to be a fiction piece that is called Our Lady of Zion, which deals with the theory that the Ark of the Covenant actually rests in Axum, Ethiopia. And don't have a lot of time to get into that, but what if that's true? And what if extremists stole the Ark of the Covenant to blackmail the Israeli government into getting a Palestinian homeland? So that's my second book, and I'm about halfway done with that.
Cool. Hey, that stuff interests me.
Yeah,
like all
definitely.
those theories of in the Da Vinci Code and things like that, you know, that the Holy Grail wasn't a cup, it was a person and things like that. Those kind of stories. I think that's why the Masons intrigue me, because there's so much mystery about the Knights Templar and everything else there that just really interests me, and I'd love to get into the history of that. So,
oh yeah, there's a whole different show in that. Me and my wife went to Paris for the 100th anniversary of the Templars' arrest in Paris. So yeah, I can talk about the Templars and those type things for another couple hours. Well, you'll have me back.
Definitely. We'll definitely have to have you back. Because there's a... I don't think we've covered even, not even half the stories that are in your book here. So, I mean, there's things about Aleister Sinclair, the Skull and Bone Society, and Elvis Presley we never touched on, Graham Parsons, a lot of things in there. So make sure you visit his websites there and pick up Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. Well, I want to thank you, Brian, for joining us.
Definitely.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Love to have him back to talk about the Templar.
Definitely.
The Knights there.
So next week, we got a ball game. We're going to start late. It'll be hopefully at 8 p.m., but whenever the ball game stops, whenever that's over, we'll have psychic and criminal profiler Robbie Thomas here. So make sure you come back and join us here on Haunted America Radio every Sunday from 7 to 9 here on 1370 AM WBTN.